for part of the beer, perhaps. Right, well, thank you all for coming on this evening. We do try and be topical in the CSDG, and I'd like to think that tonight's talk is about as topical as it can get. And we'd like to have Oliver with us from economics. There wasn't we've had an economics talk, but there was a tradition in Cambridge with economics stroke finance. And he's going to talk to us about the impact of uncertainty on trade agreements between the UK and the EU. Oliver, all yours.
Great, thanks. So I've got an hour. But maybe I'm happy to take questions throughout. I mean, we've only got a small group, so just as easy to take questions throughout. So I'm going to talk about UK firms in international trade. And so there's actually sort of three parts to the talk. So as this is sort of an interdisciplinary data science talk, there's going to be quite an emphasis on the sort of data side of it. And depending on how interesting people find it, I can discuss quite a lot about the sort of data source, which might be of interest to everyone, and then also talk about some of my research using these data sources and thinking about, exactly as Peter was saying, what we can learn from these fantastic data sources about the impact of the Brexit referendum on UK exports. So I think it was actually the data that got me really excited about working in trade, because we hear a lot nowadays about big data. And everyone's talking about how they're working with big data, or how big data is the future. But I think there's always a question of exactly how do you define big data? What makes it big? Is it the total amount of size that it takes up on your memory and your computer? Is it the number of variables, the number of observations? And one of the things I like about trade data, but a lot of data that people are using in economics nowadays, is it almost is defined as the biggest data that you can get. You can now get data on every single individual, every firm, every transaction. Anything that is now recorded as a tax goes into a database, and then as a researcher, you can access it. And so what I'm going to talk about today is how I managed to get hold of that data in the UK, both on what firms in the UK trade around the world, but then also more information about those firms. I was actually able to link that data and create a more complete picture of the universe of firms and how they interact with different countries around the world. So I have two disclaimers that I have to make. The first about institutions. I'm currently an employee at the Department for International Trade, and I was an employee at the Bank of England for part of this work. And all of the views today are my own and of neither institution. And I also use data from both HMRC and ONS. And again, this is all research and might not and certainly doesn't imply the endorsement of either institution, and may not reproduce national statistics. So as I said, I'm going to sort of have three parts to today's discussion. So the first, some facts and a discussion about the data. The second, then, as sort of Peter alluded to, thinking about the impact of uncertainty that has resulted from the renegotiation of trade agreements following Brexit. And then the third, thinking about exchange rates and whether large depreciations, such as the one we had after the Brexit referendum, whether they lead to export booms. So a lot of publicly available data, the type of data that you might see in the news, is often very aggregated. it's about how much does the UK trade with the world, how much does the UK trade with Europe or the US. But it isn't countries that import or export. Fundamentally, these are firms, there are actual real firms behind these transactions. And these aggregate statistics are just exactly that. They're aggregates. So they've aggregated up over all of these different transactions to be able to create a single statistic that we can use and we can understand what's happening in the aggregate. But actually that might hide quite a lot of really valuable information. So if you just were to take the trade data, for instance, you don't know which firms are trading in your economy. You don't know how concentrated. If we export around 140 billion pounds worth of exports to the EU, is that 10 firms each exporting 14 billion pounds each? Or is that a huge number of firms all exporting a little bit? And this is really important because when you think about economic shocks, such as Brexit, then whether this is a large number of small firms or a small number of large firms might change both how you might expect firms to respond, but also it could also then imply differences for the aggregate, because if you have a real concentration of activity in a small number of firms, and if just one of those firms decides, for instance, to leave the UK, then that would, or to stop trading with Europe, then that would have a really big impact on aggregate figures. And there's also a lot of other information that can be really useful here. So what sectors are these firms in? How important are these firms for employment or turnover? And so as part of the work that I did, I constructed a new data set. So I was able to get access to the customs transactions, so every import and export in the UK to the rest of the world, to non-EU, obviously has to go through customs. Firms have to fill in a customs declaration, which contains a huge amount of information, so not just where they're selling it to and which firm was selling it, but also the value of each transaction, the number of units, or the weight of each transaction. Then a whole other load of information as well. What currency the transaction was in, what ports, what mode of transport it went through. And all of this data is really valuable. And then in addition to that, I was able to link this with the actual firms. So I was able to, this data was stored by ONS, but fundamentally comes from PAYE transactions, which tells you the number of employees that each firm has. And also their VAT returns. So that tells you their amount of turnover that they have, and also which sector they're in. Are they a manufacturing firm or are they a services firm? Within manufacturing, which industries are they in? So in many countries, this is quite an easy thing to do. You think these are both tax data sets. Firms surely have one tax identifier and you can just easily match them. And you basically just can splice these two data sets together. Unfortunately, in the UK, there are 7 different tax reference numbers that a firm can have, and each data set has a completely different one, and they're not at the same level of aggregation. So actually doing this linking and merging was a highly non-trivial exercise that in the end, it took me 3 years to get all of the pieces of the puzzle to put together. But we got there in the end, yes.
Just curious, when you say holding up on them, there is no unified tax number.
Well, so I guess it's partly an artifact of so the British tax system is a bit weird. I mean, even with, so I think it essentially goes back to privacy in the 19th century. So So there was a great concern that people who were in charge of the tax administration, that they'd be able to work out who you were. So they came up with this really elaborate system where no individual could be able to see all of these different firms, all these different individuals. And I think, so it's sort of been built from that, and this has sort of been an underlying premise, and has sort of encouraged every different tax to have a completely different identifier and to be at a very different number. I mean, there are some things which make sense. So just, for instance, the level at which you might define a corporation might be different from the level at which you define a trader for VAT purposes. So that might make sense in terms of just that different level of aggregation. But I think part of it really is this artifact of wanting things to be private and making it difficult to do the very thing that I, and as a researcher, you would want to be able to do. But fortunately, I did get some help from people both at HMRC and at ONS who could see the value in doing this. But I guess the other thing to note is whilst these publicly available data, you can obviously just go online and just find out how much the UK exports to any country and of any product, so sort of 10,000 different products. But as soon as you move to this administrative or micro data, everything becomes very confidential. And you have to apply as a researcher and get it accepted as a project. You have to go through security checks. Your institution has to take on huge liability in case you misuse the data. And in the case of the HMRC data, you have to go down to a windowless box in London to go and use the data, and you're not allowed to just take it away with you. So basically you have to do all of the analysis that I'm going to show you down in Canary Wharf now.
It resembles sort of an approach to the medical records.
Yeah, I think it's actually slightly stricter than the medical records, but it's all worth it. In this country, it's free. If you get hold of the French data, you have to pay for it. Although they also give you a box, so you can use it wherever you want. So the rest of the talk is mostly about what you can learn from this data. So if there are no further questions on what the data is or how I got it, I'll sort of jump.
What about the French data? Is it annual?
So the trade data is daily. It literally is every transaction. The firm level data is reported at different intervals depending on how large the firm is. So normally it's annual. They make it annual because most firms report VAT annually. I was actually able to get hold of a quarterly data set where for any firm, they're updating their turnover on annual intervals, but different firms have different periods in the year when they report. Obviously, PAYE and employment, that's just a static snapshot. So that was evolving over the quarters. So some of the work I'm going to show is done at annual frequency, some's done at half-yearly frequency, some's done at quarterly frequency, depending on what was the most appropriate. Okay, so the first section is about just basic facts and sort of understanding why this is important. So in the UK, there are about 3 million firms. There are a small number of firms not included in this data set. They're typically sort of self-employed individuals, people that don't exceed the VAT reporting threshold of £82,000 a year turnover. But it's thought that this data set accounts for about 99.9% of economic activity. And it matches a lot of aggregate, so we have almost 33 million people employed. That is the same number that is reported by the ONS. In terms of turnover, it's about 5 trillion, which is very similar to some of the GDP estimates. And then the export and import data matches almost exactly national statistics. So in this linked data, I'm able to identify 4 different types of firms that we might think are interesting. So firms that don't have any international trading activity, these non-traders, exporters, so firms that only export, importers, which are firms that only import, and then two-way traders, so these are firms that both import and export. And we can see that the vast majority, 97% of firms, don't engage in international trade. Yep.
Not the slight trade.
Pardon?
The slight trade.
Yeah, I can show the slides.
Yes, I can put them on the web.
Yeah, I think maybe don't put them on the web, but I can share them to people that attended and if people email asking.
Yeah, obviously, you move in everything that you consider inappropriate to share.
Yeah, I mean, so it has all been cleared, so there's nothing that's confidential here. Yeah, just maybe given my job, I don't want them to be online and shared too widely, but I'm happy to share them upon request. Yeah, so we see that, 3 million, 97% of firms aren't engaged in international trade. But then when we look across, we can see that actually firms that trade account for over 30% of employment. And these 3% of firms that trade account for over 50% of output or turnover. So although they're very small in number, they're very large in terms of economic importance. And then if we look at even within those firms, which are the most important, well, it's these firms that both import and export, these firms that are really engaged in international trade that account for 23% of employment and 43% of turnover. Similarly, when we look at the trade statistics, it's the firms that import and export, these really large firms, that also account for the lion's share of export and import activity. So already we can see that economic activity is highly concentrated in firms that matter a lot for employment and output, but also account for the majority of trade and are both importing and exporting. So I mentioned that we also have the sector or the industry of firms. And here there's sort of less surprising figures. So if we look at which firms which sectors firms are in that export and import, we can see that it's predominantly the manufacturing and the wholesale and retail sectors. And they're disproportionately, the point of this table is to show that they're disproportionately important in terms of their trading activity compared to the number of firms or percent of firms that they are in the economy and also their share of employment and turnover.
Is it not true? Well, what is other that is 60% of turnover?
There's a services.
So for financial services.
Yeah, so financial services, business services, education, healthcare. So the reason I put them as other here is just because they're not sectors typically associated with trade. So there are also a few anomalies where you see that the exports and imports is quite high in the other sector. Part of the problem here is that let's say you're a large accountancy firm like Deloitte, and you import or export Deloitte branded pencils, then you might be classed as an importing or exporting firm, and it might total quite a lot in terms of export and import value, but
this
you're
will
not
will not affect too much unless those pencils are very expensive.
No, but this is turnover just based on the whole firm, so. If you, so I mean, here, this is just aggregates across the whole economy. So your big accountancy firms and your financial services firms account for a significant amount of turnover. So that's why this other is so dominant in terms of both, well, the percent of firms, percent of employment, and percent of turnover.
So because I'm so disconnected, I just wanted to understand how it hits to my day-to-day life. In that case, lending will be expert if some big bank of in the UK lends money to French. Will it be exporting?
So this is all goods.
Oh, okay, so it's not those bank integrations, it's actually selling something physical.
Yeah, so this is all physical trade. So no, it's a good point though, because firms do trade services, but unfortunately they don't fill out a customs declaration whenever they trade services. So actually it's much more difficult to actually track trade and services. It's all just electronic transactions, and I don't specialize in that, thank goodness. So I mean, to sort of speed things up a bit, we can look at even within these sectors, so manufacturing and wholesale and retail. So again, we can see that firms that trade are very important. They account for a significant share of the sector employment and turnover, even if they're a relatively small number of firms. So only 15% of manufacturing firms are engaged in international trade, but they account for over 60% of employment, 70%, 75% of turnover. We can also, again, think about, are these trading firms special? So here I plot some density, kernel density distributions. Again, split across the four types of firms. And here we see that, if you sort of look where the sort of modal point is, that firms that trade are to the right, so they're significantly larger in terms of employment, and we also see that the whole distribution is shifted to the right. So we have more very large firms that are engaged in international trade. And we see that not just for employment, but we see it for turnover, and we see it for productivity. And this is interesting because there's actually a lot of economic theory as well behind this. Which basically says that in order to be able to start exporting, if there's a sunk cost required to set up your international distribution network, maybe you have to hire someone to be able to fill out your customs paperwork, then it's only going to be the firms that have the lowest costs or are the most productive that are going to be willing to undertake that cost and to start exporting. So again, I've sort of mentioned that we have this very concentrated exporting and importing. And again, we see that. So if you look at the top 10% of exporters, so just 6,000 firms account for 93% of exports. The top 1%, so just 600 firms, account for 71% of UK exports. So it's very granular. It's a very small number of firms account for the lion's share of economic activity. That's not to say that these small exporters don't matter, because although they only account for 6% of exports, these firms do still account for 15% of all employment in the UK and 26% of turnover. So when we start to think about how these small firms, the ones that might be most affected by something like Brexit, how they might be affected, well, that could still have implications for the wider economy, because they do still account for quite a significant proportion of economic activity, but they're just not as large as these huge mega firms, these superstar firms.
When you're comparing that, if you account for, say, their supply chain in terms of employment, what it really takes to get a good economy?
So obviously this is just direct, so this is just at that firm itself. There's a whole separate literature thinking about the implications for if one large firm goes bust, how does that ripple through the supply chain? And yeah, again, that's a significant concern when you're thinking about the impact of something like Brexit. And then another interesting thing that I was able to identify, so in this data we also had information on where, or the nationality of the company in terms of their ownership structure, and also whether they had foreign subsidiaries. So if you think of firms that are foreign owned and have lots of foreign subsidiaries as potentially being the most mobile in response to a shock like Brexit, then it's quite concerning that such a high proportion of these really large firms in the top 10% or the top 1%, that the majority of them are actually foreign owned, and the majority of them have foreign subsidiaries. And 35% of these top, so this is top 1% of each exporters and importers, there's actually just 300 firms, but a third of them are both foreign owned and have foreign subsidiaries. So if you think about very mobile firms in response to a shock like Brexit, you might expect these to be very mobile.
Yep.
So subsidiaries is like if you are, if you have like a plant or an affiliate abroad. So if you're...
So it's not that you are being owned, but you own something.
Exactly. So let's say your Rolls-Royce engines, they have a manufacturing plant in the US, and that's an affiliate or a subsidiary. So they're a British company, or it could even be a foreign-owned company, but the fact that it then has subsidiaries abroad, whereas foreign-owned would be something, let's say like Nissan or Toyota, so a Japanese company, but here in the UK. So. Okay, so that was a set of facts, and now I consider how we can use this data for more inference and more analysis. So this next set of slides is from a project which was looking at the impact of renegotiating trade agreements, the impact of the uncertainty caused by Brexit on firm exporting behavior. So the motivation behind this paper was that historically we've always associated with renegotiating trade agreements as moving towards more liberal trade. So whether that's through multiple rounds of World Trade Organization negotiating rounds, whether it's free trade agreements like the ones that we've seen between Canada and the EU, or the EU and Japan, or CPTPP. But all of these trade agreements were always based on the premise that if negotiations sort of collapsed, you'd just keep the status quo. But recently we've seen a whole set of new types of negotiations where if negotiations collapsed, trade barriers would actually increase. So I'm going to look at the UK and the EU renegotiating their trade agreement, which is kicking off right now. The US in NAFTA, President Trump came in and threatened to withdraw the US from NAFTA, and that obviously has been renegotiated and ratified as the USMCA. And also the US and Korea had a similar situation. So the sort of research question was, well, how do firms respond to these renegotiations where there's a threat that tariffs could increase? So we look at Brexit, which is a really interesting natural experiment, because obviously leaving the EU is a significant change in the UK's trade policy. And we know that trade agreements typically lower barriers and provide certainty, but the threat that this could be revoked actually created a period of uncertainty for firms. And so we look and we find that UK firms responded to this threat that tariffs could increase. So this isn't that they did change, but just the threat that they could change in the future has changed firms' exporting behavior. So I'm sure this is probably why not many people have turned up, because everyone's sick with hearing about Brexit. But obviously, on the 23rd of June, British electorate voted to leave, and the government decided that that meant that the UK would leave the customs union. So the UK and the EU began negotiations or renegotiations, but there was a chance that those negotiations could break down. I mean, they still could break down. And there's a clear outside option if there is no deal, which would be that UK and EU trade would be conducted under World Trade Organization rules. And under those rules, UK exports to the EU would be charged the EU's external tariff rate, so the same rates that the EU applies to the US, the same rates that the EU applies to China. And that's defined by the EU's WTO applied MFN tariff schedule. So what's really nice as an economist is that this was unexpected. So here I've plotted sort of predicted odds from betting markets, sourced from Betfair in the year leading up to the referendum. Over the whole year, the probability was just 30% that the UK was going to vote to leave. In fact, on the day of the referendum, it was at 12%. So even on the day of the referendum, it was a complete shock, the result. So what this means is it means that we have a big jump in terms of this uncertainty. So even if perhaps it wasn't zero in the run-up to the referendum, it certainly increased a lot from either 30%, or you could even argue from 12%, up to 100%. And so that significantly increased the likelihood that the UK and EU would renegotiate their trade agreement.
How reliable are these data in terms of sources?
Well, so this is what's so nice. So this is betting market data. So this is literally put your money where your mouth is. So, I mean, people use this quite a lot in terms of, obviously, it's difficult to tell exactly what you mean by probability, but at the end of the day, someone could have put money on this and made money out of it. So I think it's typically seen as a good indicator of sort of expected probability. So obviously, the true probability was always 100%. We know ex post what the result was. But in terms of sort of anticipated expectations, this is pretty accurate. So that's going to give us a shock that varies across time, before and after the referendum. But also we get variation across different products. Because we said that UK firms would suddenly face the EU's common external tariff. But actually, we know what that is, and it varies across different products. So for some products, it's zero. Like 28% of products, it's zero, which accounts for 40% of UK export value and 20% of exporters, of firm product exporters, it was zero. So for those products, there was no increase in the threat of future tariffs. On the other hand, there were some products for whom they would face a 15% or higher than 15% tariff under a no-deal scenario. I mean, if you go to tobacco, it goes all the way up to 74.9%. If you look at specific duties and quotas, I mean, it goes up to 200% in sort of ad valorem equivalent terms for certain agriculture products. For some products, such as cars, it would be 10% tariff. So we have this wide heterogeneity across different types of products that could face different tariff rates. So here's just plotting in terms of the number of exporters across a whole range of different industries, and sort of color coding these different bins of different tariff rates. So,
is it clear from the previous slide that more than 90% of the export will not exceed 15% of tariff anymore. So all this, I don't know, scare stories from TV that all this will be, I don't know, wall on the borders, no sort of movement of goods. 15% is, well, actually, it is important, but considering that, I don't know, Tesco puts, I don't know, twofold or threefold addition to the raw cost.
Yeah,
it,
so
it,
I mean,
it actually doesn't matter in major things. It's, it, it is adjustment, and that's it. It's not, no ruining the economy.
Yes, I mean, they're certainly not zero, but they're also not humongous, and I think there's more concern, I think, about sort of the non-tariff barriers, and that is true. So differences in regulation, just needing to produce customs declarations.
So it was worth nothing today.
Well, but on the other hand, if you're a car producer, 10% tariff is quite big. If you're a if you're a volume car producer, your profit margin is 6%. So
it's
actually,
margin, isn't it? I mean, you know, some of them are working. Perhaps they're quite a close sort of break even. And I mean, it's difficult to disaggregate, isn't it? Some of them could really struggle even with a 5%, perhaps.
Exactly, and it depends how competitive your competitors are as well. I mean, the real test is whether firms change their behavior. If we find that they do change their behavior, then it probably suggests that they are significant. So here's just sort of plotting across these different sectors. So we see a lot of textile producers. I actually have other graphs where I plot it in terms of value, which looks a little bit different. Especially transport increases a lot. The orange that we have here on transport, if we look at value, it's about up here. It's much higher. That's the car sector.
Plastic, is it?
Yes, yeah, plastics.
Number of exporters?
What do you care about the numbers then? Why is it the value of
Yeah, so I mean, just in terms of the analysis that I'm going to do is more focused on the number of firms, and that's because, coming back to this idea of which firms will change their behavior, it's the small firms for whom they have lower margins that this matters more for, so we'll see them change their behavior. Whereas the big firms, if you're Nissan, the threat of a 10% tariff isn't going to stop you exporting to Europe. But if you're a small boutique car producer, then maybe it would. So, yeah.
Considering what, that there is not much of red and orange, that actually for most of these, columns, bars, it's medium at the worst exposure.
Yeah.
It's again sort of rather encouraging.
Oh yeah, I mean, MFN tariffs aren't super high, but for those firms that do face the really high tariffs, it will change their behavior a lot.
And the state can support them because of this Russian, if it's in public interest.
Well, then you fall foul of state aid rules, and then lose even more access. So. Yeah, then it gets classed as subsidies, and then the EU can put massive tariffs on. So you have to be very careful about it. So I've not put in the mathematical modelling that we did, the theoretical modelling, but we sort of applied Brexit to sort of an existing model, and it gave us some empirical predictions. So these probably won't surprise you, but for products facing high potential tariffs under a sort of no-deal scenario, we got a result that predicts sort of decreased entry in sort of the post-Brexit referendum period relative to pre-Brexit referendum period. For products facing higher potential tariffs. It predicts increased exit, and then overall a fall in the number of exporters. So coming back to the question of value, the model actually has no predictions in terms of the value response. It's not exactly clear whether firms would try to increase sales before exiting later, or whether they would also lower their values. So this is another reason why we're focused on the number of exporters. In terms of the empirical model, so we use just simple regression analysis, regressing the growth in the number of entrants between 2016, so sort of the post-referendum period, and 2015, the pre-referendum period. And we regressed that at the product H level, so we had 8,500 different products. And we regressed that on the potential MFN tariff that these firms could face, which we're able to just download. And then we do a set of additional robustness. So I guess one thing to note first, in the sort of theoretical modeling, we discuss entrants and exiters. So we don't see in the data something that says this firm has entered. But because we have all of the data, we can actually identify when a firm enters and when a firm exits.
May I ask
again
slightly about modeling? So you have small predefined detected by the time of referendum, when this was in use for everyone and everyone intuitively reacted. But will you project it to the same situation when people are already coming to Brexit as a fact? So you expect that people will behave in the same way as when they first knew about it? Is it, if I got it right?
So I mean, it will depend. So I mean, if at the end of this year the UK crashes out without a deal, you could look at it again. I mean, so you could sort of calibrate the theoretical model based on some of this, but there you still then need to make some assumptions. And we actually chose not to do that because we weren't comfortable in making some of the assumptions that we needed to make. We just didn't have data
everything is how we assume it. It's in terms of understanding.
Yep.
So the model was projecting behavior of people at the day of referendum to how they will behave at the day of Brexit. In essence.
So we're purely looking at the uncertainty. So we're not thinking about if, let's say, at the end of this year there's a hard Brexit, we're not thinking about that. We're purely thinking about just this uncertainty and understanding how the impact of uncertainty can affect firms' exporting decisions. So as I was saying, so we can actually identify when firms enter and exit. So if we see a firm exporting in 2015, when they weren't exporting in 2014, we can tell that they've entered the market. Similarly, if we see that firm exporting in 2015 and then not exporting in 2016, we can say that they've exited the market. So coming back to this benefit of having the universe of data rather than just survey data, we can actually tell when firms are entering and exiting the market. So we then run this regression analysis, so in line with our empirical predictions, we do find reduced entry and increased exit in the products that face the higher threat point tariffs. And we also perform a series of robustness analysis where we control for sensitivity to the exchange rate, potential supply or global demand shocks, and then we also do some intra-year analysis and show that this was very much driven around the timing of the referendum within subsections of the year. So to quantify how big this is, we can use the regression analysis. So products facing a 10 percentage point threat point tariff would have a 10.5 percentage point lower growth of entry into exporting than the growth of entry of the sort of zero tariff group. So overall, we see that for those products, an overall growth rate of minus 1.9%. So we did think that the sort of base, this 8.6%, was quite high. Again, this could be sort of for multiple reasons. The EU was growing quite rapidly in 2016. And so what we're really exploiting here is the differences across different products. So we're using the products facing no threat of tariffs as sort of the control group, as the sort of baseline, and how other products changed differently to that.
Sometimes it's difficult to follow when the topic is very disconnected from what you're doing.
Yep.
It's like you were listening about genetics. I don't know.
I would understand nothing about
genetics.
Sorry,
that's stupid and repetitive. So your prediction is about what happens between 20 and 21, based on what you know about what happened between 15 and 16.
No. So we're purely just estimating what happened.
It's
so this is purely historical. What happened in 2016 relative to 2015?
Okay, it's a historical description. It's not regression of future.
No. So it's not predicting.
Because you said about regression, it could be estimation of slopes, historical estimation, or could be, I don't know, attempt to claim this will happen again. No, it's just historical estimate.
Yeah. So I am aware, I think in data science, regression means something different to in economics or in econometrics. So this is sort of like ordinary least squares regression. It's just pure statistical analysis. It's not modeling and prediction.
Regression is sort of predicting of a clinical response.
Yeah. Yeah, no. So it's not prediction. So I will come back to that, though. So we then look at sort of quantifying this across different types of products. So before, it was just a continuous measure of the tariff. So we now put in the different categories that we have, so the low tariffs, that's sort of 0 to 5%, medium tariffs 5 to 10, high 10 to 15, extreme, and then these quotas. And again, we find that there's a significant increase in the growth rate of exit of products facing higher threat point tariffs, and we find lower entry in products facing the higher threat point tariffs.
And because it's discussion, I'm trying to interrupt occasionally,
it's fine.
How would you explain intuition for, again, non-economist, why not the exit and entry are different variations?
So the theory is, if you're a firm thinking about whether to start exporting, if you have this fixed cost setting up your distribution network, but there's a threat that tomorrow that tariffs might increase, so that has two effects. One is it just lowers the expected return, the mathematical expectation, but also that variance also means that you'd rather not pay it today and make that choice tomorrow.
So you stop selling it abroad. You stop planning to sell it abroad. But
exactly.
Why the entry is changing to be the...
So that's me deciding whether to start, because I have to pay that upfront cost. But suppose you were already exporting. If you have already set up your distribution network, you might think, oh, why does it matter? Surely you keep selling until the tariff kicks in. But we also know that this changes for firms. So I might be selling to Peter today, and then Peter might go bust, or Peter might choose to buy from somebody else. So then me as a firm, I'm sort of back to square one. I either have to set up a new distribution network, or I decide I'm not going to sell anymore to France, well, let's say Peter is. So in that case, I'm faced with a similar decision that we'd expect from an entrant. And what was interesting is we see this, but we see that the impact on exit is actually smaller than, at least in absolute terms, than the impact on entry. So again, that fits with this story that this effect is most acute for when you're thinking about starting to export, but also it would affect you if you already were exporting. At least that's in terms of the theory. You can also have more intensive decisions as well.
I mean, how can we trust that model when the R squared is really invisible?
So the reason that the R squared is so low is A, because there's just a huge amounts of variation, and B, so the way we've actually specified this in terms of the growth rates always leads to really low R squared. Like, often when you see these sorts of models, they can have rearranged it and have lots of fixed effects, which have huge explanatory power, but we've basically stripped out all of that. So we've stripped out like sort of trend rates of growth. So it's sort of not surprising that the overall explanatory power is quite low. But also, as an economist, I actually don't care about total explanatory power. All I care about is the number of stars that I find on that, which shows that this is a significant effect.
I think so these are all relationships more than prediction.
Exactly. I'm not looking at prediction at all.
That's the difference in
our system. But again, coming back to, if you do care about prediction, then, and you wanted a really high R squared, you could have re-specified it with loads of fixed effects, and basically that would be capturing all of these trend rates of entry, trend rates of growth. So you'd basically be like massively saturating your model. Whereas we sort of stripped that out.
Yeah, but you still assume that the cost of variance, of course.
Yep.
So why are the centrist constant is a linear variance?
So I mean, the Hedrick elasticity would not lead to bias. It would just affect the standard error, right? So I mean, it wouldn't change the point estimates. So so we then say, well, we've found all of these point estimates, but what do they mean in practice? So we then go and we say, well, when we look here, we have sort of our base group, these constants, and then we have all of these different product categories. Now, what would have happened if all of these different categories would have been like the constant and not faced any tariff uncertainty? So not to say that Brexit completely didn't happen, this is more the world where Brexit happens, but Theresa May had committed to staying in the customs union with no tariff uncertainty. So we do a sort of partial equilibrium aggregation and sort of aggregate over a number of firms and these growth rates. And we estimate that entry would have been about 5.1% higher in 2016 if UK firms hadn't have faced this tariff uncertainty. And exit would have been 4.3% lower. Yeah. Going back to the...
Entry, that means that firm starts exporting, and exit, that means firm stops exporting.
Exactly. And then there's a question of, well, why didn't this make more of the news? What this seems like a big number.
Yeah. Overall, less than 1% of net change.
I know, 5% of entry is still quite a lot. But one of the things we know, and one of the things we saw earlier, actually we didn't show this, but anyway. But small firms and entrants are small, typically small, don't account for much activity relative to the big large firms. So actually, we sort of put a value on this, and we find that if you were to use sort of the average value for entrants, this only accounts to about £225 million of lost export value, which compared to sort of aggregate value of £140 billion that the UK sends to the EU every year, is very low. So it's sort of not surprising, but I think the question is more, is this indicative of what might happen in a no-deal scenario? Is it indicative on sort of what might happen over time as this uncertainty plays out? This was just when we had the data for 2016. Now you'd have data, what, up to 2018, 2019. Maybe you see greater effects over time. So I'm not going to go through all of the robustness because we're pushing on the time, but we do look at a variety of different robustness techniques. But what I'm going to focus on is a shorter presentation. There's only 4 or 5 slides here, which is saying, do large depreciations lead to export booms?
Right, but really since some humans want machines, the bottom drops down.
Yeah. So, although we don't like using down, because actually we often invert the index, it becomes weaker, you can buy fewer euros. So what else happened during the referendum? Well, immediately after the referendum, the sterling index, so this dotted green line, the pound depreciated by about 15% on the day of the referendum. So again, coming back to that unexpected shock, it wasn't priced into the markets. And then if we look at what happened to the value of exports, it also increased, which seems a bit counter to what I just showed you before, which said that the uncertainty, at least in products facing potentially higher tariffs... Yeah. But here, this is saying that actually UK exports increased by 20% before and after. So it's pretty flat before, and then basically had this step jump.
In what unit is
this? This is the sterling value.
So in fact you export exactly the same, but it costs a different number of dollars. So no change.
So this is what I'm going to show.
Yeah.
But this wasn't what any of the politicians were saying. They were saying, we've had this massive Brexit dividend, we've had this huge increase, this surge in exports.
It was actually 1% decrease in nature or form, but in form of pounds, it was all successful politics.
Yeah. So, we can, again, use in the microdata, we have information on the quantity and the prices. So also that one before, that was across different products. So this is now just focusing on sort of the aggregate. So this is now for each firm that was exporting, what happened to them before and then after the depreciation. So again, in terms of, colors aren't great, but in terms of the value, we see a big jump in value. But this was predominantly, at least initially, caused by prices rather than quantities. This is very much that you were, let's say, selling in euros and then suddenly the pound appreciates and you're converting it back into sterling, and suddenly this 20% depreciation means that you've just increased your revenue by 20%. So that's why we see this sort of immediate jump in the prices. And there's been some other work actually showing that using the currency of invoicing data, this is very much true. So all of the increase is from...
Actually, for people who employ local workforce, because you don't have change in salaries. Salaries actually were stagnating. It's in some sense subsidy for business owners or whatever.
Yep. I mean, you've also seen the opposite, right? Where people who are immigrants are now moving away because suddenly their income has just depreciated or gone down by 20% compared to their home income. So I then look and say, well, what do we see in terms of, was this actually a response to the exchange rate? So obviously I have information on every country in the world. Every country has a different exchange rate. So we were able to estimate sort of the elasticity to changes in the exchange rate across destinations and across time. And we find that the value in response to a 1% depreciation increases by 6.6%. But again, that's predominantly driven by price, so about 80% of the response is driven by price. There is some quantity response, but it's very small. And then finally, we said, well, did this response differ across different types of firms? So we know that the largest firms account for the lion's share of exports. And actually what we find is we find that actually the largest firms have the largest response, both on prices and then also on quantities. This was quite a surprising result. But this is potentially something to do with short-term supply constraints. So if you're a large firm, it's easy to ramp up production in response to some increase in competitiveness. And especially in this period of uncertainty, you might think that, again, it would be the larger firms that would be willing to respond in such a period. So here we sort of, we split the firms into 10 deciles, where so 10 is the largest firms and 1 is the smallest firms. And then we estimated this elasticity response to the exchange rate for each of these groups separately. And so, as I was saying, we see the response of the largest firms, their elasticity is up here at almost 0.7. So they're, for every 1% decrease or depreciation of the exchange rate, they increase their export value by 0.7%. Whereas down here, the smallest firms, they were down at about almost 0.5 with almost no quantity response. So they really weren't able to benefit. So the rhetoric of this export boom was definitely driven, A, more by prices, but also it was the larger firms that were actually able to benefit in terms of the quantities.
Again, what is the difference between a quantity and, let's say, medical or whatever studies? If someone said to me that, I don't know, depending on something, response rate in one group will change 0.7% and in the other group 0.5%, I would say that it's clinically not significant. It might be even statistically significant, but clinically, in most cases, it doesn't matter. So how important it is, there is no... And also in these medical things, usually they have these confidence intervals on the bars.
So, I mean, I could have plotted the confidence intervals, but you wouldn't have been able to see them.
So they're so small that it's...
Yeah. So, I mean, again, so the sample size here is 12 million. I mean, if you look here, you can see the size of the standard errors. So, I mean, every single one of these is statistically different from the one before.
And economically, it is significant.
So, I think, if you look at just comparing maybe the 10th to the 9th, you'd say it wasn't particularly significant. But certainly, if you're comparing the 10th to the 1st, 20% difference is quite significant.
So it makes sense for people in terms of making decisions.
Yeah, big difference. And certainly, I mean, here you're seeing, I mean, over 10% difference in quantity response is big.
I mean that for doctors, if you have two drugs, one which will reduce your blood pressure just 10% different from the other, well, it will not be as dramatic. Yeah, obviously you would prescribe a better one, but considering all the side effects and other stuff, or which patients actually use the drug, it might not change your behavior.
Yeah, no, and I appreciate that, and I mean, you always need to account for both the sort of statistical and the economic significance. But
my question was how important it is.
But no, I think especially here, I think these, you would say that these are economically significant as well as highly statistically significant. Okay, so that's the end of my talk. I think I pretty much took exactly the hour.
I mean, it reminds me of when you see it in growth in sales in like-for-like, you know, if they're in even 1 or 2%, they're getting a pat on the back, aren't they? And so in that context, 10% will be over the moon. You don't see many like-for-like increase in sales going up by, you know, 10% very often. So, you know, I can see that in economics, perhaps 10% is mega.
Yeah.
I mean, I think it's very interesting. This
people who didn't come lost a lot.
I think it's there a lot. I mean, to be honest,
you should try to,
I'm not gonna
to repeat this presentation in some like you did, because I think, or maybe, I don't know,
we have
not after Brexit, of course.
We've got Oliver's supervisor, she's speaking to us at the end of the month.
Oh, it's Meredith speaking?
Yeah, all of it. So,
okay.
Perhaps, you know, things like biking up there, but I think this is very accessible for personally.
For me, there were what barriers was, because obviously I'm out of the subject. I don't grasp immediately this depreciation, that is probably normal language for you. I don't grasp immediately entry and exit, because initially I mistook it as import and export.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, but it was, except for this minor thing, it was very clear message, if I got it right. I got it right, but all
I'm
this...
I'm sure you did.
all this Brexit doesn't change more than 10%, I'm saying actually 5%, of important things. So to myself, it is a matter of a judgment, not a catastrophe. And if we are talking about actually sovereignty, it is worth paying.
Well, I mean, this is just the uncertainty effect. I think. So, obviously the final effect is going to be much larger when it's actually something certain rather than something that might happen.
Well, could the picture be different if you considered different sectors? Agriculture, etc. Because you've aggregated all of them.
Yeah, we considered doing that. I mean, so obviously going back to some of the uncertainty results, our identification is coming from sort of the across different products. And so some of the robustness that I'm not showing here that we did, we sort of checked to see whether, by removing any individual sector, whether it completely changed the results, or was it just one sector driving the results, and we find that it wasn't. But we just don't have enough different, although we have, 8,500 different types of products, it still isn't enough.
I'm thinking widely, this is a simple linear regression on farms, etc. Could you not sort of think about it as a hierarchical cluster of farms, the primary effect in the next model?
Yeah, so I tried doing that, but the computer said no. unfortunately, when you're using government computers, they don't always give you supercomputers to work with. So
it's not a situation that you have to go into their room and use their computers, possibly even their software. You've got a bit of a constriction. You might have to sort of do things slightly differently than you might then have been on your own. Your own office, or
yeah, no, definitely.
But you have to be careful, because you get down to the micro level, you can identify individual companies. But anyway, I mean, very interesting, the fine tradition of economics in the group has been continued. So thank you very much, Oliver.
Thanks everyone for coming.
Cheers.
Still encouraging. I understand the psychological effect, let's say 5%, okay. But when you showed pictures not about psychology but about exposure, most of this was not orange in nature. Most of this was blue.